My name is Will McDonald. All my Army and tax records call me Willis B. But I'm Will McDonald. I'm a professional soldier, long retired. I joined the Army as a private, retired 20 years later as a light colonel. I trained an artillery battalion from scratch. We landed in Vietnam on Christmas Eve of 1967. While I didn't put pen to paper for these five poems, they were all bouncing around in my head. On the 10th year anniversary of the fall of Saigon, the TV had a 24-hour orgy, I guess about a 48-hour orgy. The same clips kept repeating themselves. The convoy moving down from Bamituat, the Central Highlands, to the coast. People climbing off the roof of the embassy. Soldiers pushing a Huey off the deck of a helicopter, off the deck of a carrier, so more choppers could land. My wife had some serious business in Austin, and so she was up there, and I was stuck with the kids who were still left at home in school in El Paso. The more I watched, the more depressed I became, and the more lonesome I became for my wife. On the meantime, I was sipping a lot of Jim Beam whiskey, I might add. On the second night, I just pulled out a kid's line rule tablet and wrote the five poems I'm about to tell you. But first, I gotta describe a little more on the... The first poem was not a single incident. It was repeated two or three times. All other poems were written from a single incident at a different time. One more thing needs to be explained. As I said, I brought the artillery battalion over from Long Beach to Quinyon on a troop transport. The battalion commander and the four battery commanders flew over. As soon as I got there, I found a program called Infusion. They're very smart, I might add. After 4 months, the Army would transfer a third of your unit out and give you new kids who had only about 4 months to go. And this would be repeated two more times. So this would explain why the poems have such a different background. I don't want you to think I was completely nuts. I would further request, okay, so I knew that the Infusion was coming off, and we had two captains on the road on the list for major, plus we had two majors already in the battalion. So I requested a transfer to Special Forces. It was granted, and I was asked if I would like to request another volunteer one more time for a Special Operations unit. And that was the unit I'm talking about in my second bunch. And then I came out on the list for light colonel, and I extended in Vietnam another 6 months for reasons that will be explained sometime later. Anyway, among the things, the goodies I got for extending 6 months was a free leave back to my home in El Paso. So when I got back, it was decided that I would just take my last 6 months as a deputy commander of Special Forces, parentheses, for installation defense. I was no more a deputy than I was Batman, but since the commander was given the responsibility of defending the city, he had to have a little thing like this in order to get it done. Now you understand the three different assignments. Now the first poem is called Silent Jungle Night. Now let me give you just a tiny bit of a glossary. Number one, and this went true for World War II, which I wasn't in, but the Germans had green tracer ammunition. Well, that's something they do in Europe, I guess. And so in Korea, the communists all had green tracers, and in Vietnam, they had green tracers. Americans always had red tracers. There wasn't any political or something to do with the chemistry. And the second thing is, a silent jungle night is a two-phase deal, because a jungle is much like being in downtown New York City at 2 in the morning. You think it's silent, But it isn't, because there's taxis screeching and horns honking and stuff in the background. But compared to the day, it's very silent. Well, in the jungle, and I can't explain it, you would think it's a silent night. But every once in a while, something happens. And then you realize that there was an awful lot of noise going on. Most of it is little goofy beetles and things like that. All of a sudden, they all stop at the same time. That in itself is nerving. It's unnerving. How do they understand to all do it at one time on cue? A mountain yard told me one time it means someone's going to die. Cheerful thought. But basically, if you're in an ambush or something, and they settle down and you're there 2 or 3 hours, you're part of the silent jungle night. When things get totally silent, that means someone or something is creeping down the trail. Now, it could be as simple as a tiger about to get a monkey. Now, I never saw a tiger in Vietnam, but I know they had them. They were usually further out in the bush than I was. Most of them probably were in Cambodia. But anyway, that's the second stage of a silent jungle night. If you were sitting there in what you thought was silence and suddenly it dropped, it was really unnerving. Anyway, here we go. Silent jungle night. There is nothing like the terror of a silent jungle night. When mortars crunch and green fingers of death claw the sky, there's a compensating high that can never be explained or even understood. But when you're talking terror, there is nothing. There is nothing like the terror of a silent jungle night. Now, as I mentioned, we went over as an artillery unit, and we were stationed in Ankay. Ankay was the base camp of the 1st CAV, but they'd been there a long time, and they had basically moved out. Their headquarters, their division headquarters was there, but basically they were gone. Now, they were on a little plateau halfway between the lowlands and the highlands. And from the Ankay Pass coming up the hills to the little Ankay plateau was something out of National Geographic. You were right up against a wall and you looked down to this beautiful, beautiful green vista, fields and peasants working in the fields and all that. It was just gorgeous. Ankay was a tremendously big camp. It had about 25,000 people in it at one time. And it got close to that all the time. They had just a tremendous amount of aircraft there and things like that. So not just combat soldiers. They were surrounded by a big fence. They called it the Green Line because at night it was lit in an eerie green light. And helicopters patrolled at night to see that there was no intruders. And of course, sometimes there was plenty of intruders, but that's another story. Anyway, the division had a rear detachment, and they had from Ankay up to the Pleiku Highlands, there was a thing called the Menyang Pass. And everything the first one was, this one wasn't. It was a little steeper. The jungle had come right up to the road, so it had been defoliated, and then it had been knocked down with roan plows. Now, a roan plow is nothing but a bulldozer with some armament on it. And they'd knocked down the trees, so from the air, it looked wonderful. You had 200 yards on each side of the trail. However, the trees were 8 feet around, and they were all over the place, just knocked down. So frankly, if it hadn't been for air power, we could have put a regimental combat team up next to the road. Nobody would have seen it while driving on the road. It was a spooky place. Actually, the Korea Battalion had been massacred to the man at the top of the pass, but that's another story. But it was littered with the garbage of war. There was probably 24 trucks, both civilian and military, that had been unfortunate enough to hit a mine. Usually, of course, the whole thing's burned up. And we had this garbage there. Many times they had to come and push it aside with a tank or something. There was a goofy-looking French armored car on its side, burned out. It had been there 20 years, I guess. There was another French tank. It was really a mess. And as you got to the top, there was a line of 25 18-wheelers lined up like they were crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, all burned out. That had happened 3 or 4 years earlier when Americans were a little, maybe, no, not that long, a couple of years earlier when we were a little more innocent. Anyway, there was a camp called Shooter, a little fire base at the bottom of the pass, and it was commanded by a young captain, had a rifle company there, and they were all short-timers. They were good men, they were experienced men, but they were giving them a break because it really wasn't like walking through the jungles. This young captain was there because he had been decorated 2 or 3 times. I'm not sure about his Distinguished Service Cross, whether he received it, but I know he'd gone in for it. Anyway, it was considered a pretty cushy job. So whenever there was problems on the trail, they would send a reaction force. They had an artillery battery who was split in half over the bottom, and he had a rifle squad with each half of the rifle of the artillery battery, and the rest of the people were in Shooter. So what we had here was an ambush within an ambush. We had a very large convoy going through. I had some of my people were there, but there was a lot of other stuff, ash and trash going up to Pleiku, to the post exchange and all that, because we never in Vietnam could tell the difference between luxuries and necessities. So the trucks were going out filled with soda pop and beer and many nice things, plus rations and ammunition. Well, somebody fired a B-40 rocket into the engine of one of the trucks. Of course, it exploded. Glass and pot metal and everything showered all over the place. And we had people in there, and the convoy responded right out of Fort Benning. It was fantastic. Everybody, the assistant drivers, started firing off to the right. There was a few people looking off to the left to make sure they didn't get something. Everyone kept moving. They kept their interval. Nobody panicked. When they crossed past the smoking truck, it was between the enemy and them, the moving trucks. So the driver and assistant driver jumped on board, took up the fire, and within 5 minutes, they'd all passed, and the truck was sitting there burning, but the engine was burning out of it, but there was no more action going on. No, nothing else had happened to the convoy. Up came 2 APCs with a young infantry commander, and they jumped out and took off chasing the bad guys. This was the real ambush. There was a Claymore mine set to go off. Of course, the Claymore mine is command detonated. But it was right at about belt. It would have gone off at about belt height, which would have just cut a whole lot of people in half. Well, as the VC were moving back, getting ready for their ambush, one of them tripped over the wire, and the Claymore mine was positioned at a 45-degree angle. So when they fired it, every one of those 10,000 BBs went straight over the heads of the attacking troops, all except one BB. This is called Hero. He was just a kid. He looked a lot younger than his 26 years. Tall and tan, his hair was short and blonde. Hard to believe that innocent had fought over 2 years. Hard to believe this Beach Boy kid held 2 Silver Stars and a DSC. They'd sent him to a safe area for his last moments to ensure safe passage home to see his faithless son. He'd been through so much, hard to believe a single Claymore pellet could do that. Just a tiny hole, an inch above his eye. It didn't even bleed. The next one, you're going to have to forgive me if I lose it on this next one. We have a thing, I was still in the artillery. Of course, we had the infusion going, And so we got a new, and one of our batteries, I think it was A battery, we got, or B battery, we got a new first sergeant. Well, I'd never met him. And anyway, we had, someone had come up with a genius idea of a thing called an artillery raid. Reading in history, we realized that they did a lot of this in the Mexican War. Well, in Vietnam, especially our unit was 8-inch, 175. Every battery had four guns, two 8-inch and two 175. Heavy stuff, long range. Well, because it was so heavy and so dangerous, we didn't want to lose it. So, unfortunately, it was always behind very heavy revetments and wire and very well guarded. So we didn't get out to shoot anybody. I mean, we stayed in the same place. We had a wonderful field of fire. But the VC, after a while, you have a fan with an artillery piece, as you can logically figure. They can shoot so far to the right, so far to the left. Well, after a while, the VC had figured that out. They probably had it on the wall of a dugout someplace. So they could get out and be putting revetments in and putting in emplacements, moving stuff up and down a trail just outside the fan. And our air observer, Snoopy, used to see them every day, and he said they are moving more and more and more stuff up this trail. I mean, it was not Vietnamese commerce. It was lines of men carrying boxes on their shoulders up into a really tough area known as Indian Country. So we decided to have this artillery raid. We secretly sent the survey crew out, and they surveyed in all the data. The battery exec came out in a Jeep, very casually put his aiming circle over in a corner. Nobody noticed anything. It was out in a hard field. They also raised things besides rice there. It was a hard field that had been harvested weeks before. And we had two ammunition trucks idling out in front of the village whorehouse. That wasn't suspicious, because there was always a GI truck idling out in front of the village whorehouse. Everything was in place. Fire direction infiltrated in. I don't know how they did, where they went, but they came in quietly. And all of a sudden, the guns came roaring up, swung into position. They were laid and ready to fire within 6 minutes. And the fire direction people had already been plotting, pretty much. And so they just tidied up their work, and the rounds were in the air almost as soon as they got there. And it was a marvelous day. I thought Snoopy was going to soil himself. He got so excited up in the airplane, seeing people that had been literally ignoring him and flipping him off for the last 2 or 3 weeks, suddenly getting the business. Well, B Battery sent their new first sergeant up. Well, first sergeants and old major execs are only in a place like that to put out fires. We had no fires. This was a superbly trained unit. They were well led by their officers, were doing a fine job, their non-coms. So what did we have to do? Two old guys, the first sergeant and a battalion exec, we just stood at the rear of the gun line and shot the shit. We kept our eyes on the guns, but there was never any problems, and so we didn't have to intervene. We had a wonderful time talking. We had a lot of experiences. He'd been in the 82nd Airborne Division as a young man when I was there. We'd been in the Army roughly the same amount of time. I guess I had a couple of years on him. Anyway, that's the background. You don't need a glossary for this book, for this poem. It's called My New Friend. I met the first sergeant about noon. We were together till almost dusk. We had so much in common. He had almost as many children as I. Three even had the same names. He'd just come back from Hawaii. I was just fixing to go. We shared pictures. We had pretty wives. We'd met them both while studying high school. At 4 a.m. they woke me. B Battery had been hit. My new friend was dead. okay, now we're moving to the special operations unit. I wish I could say that I had done something worthwhile in that operations unit, because they were the highest decorated unit in the Vietnam War and had the highest casualties. But I was just an old fat staff officer. We didn't have a staff, but I was the exec, so I got all the goofy paperwork. The only thing even close to anything was, well, I'll get into that later. Anyway, we had a recon mission in Cambodia, and well, my unit was in Cambodia. Our other units were also in Laos, but all the places where the government swore to God we weren't, we were. And our job was to interdict the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And many times we called them hatchet units that went out and interdicted, but most of the time it was simply a recon. So if you listen to the guy on TV who said the 14th NVA Division entered South Vietnam from Cambodia today, confirmed American sources say, well, we were the confirmed American source. I didn't get any of that excitement. I don't want anybody to get me wrong. I was not a hero. I was just an old fat guy doing some paperwork. But one of our missions, one of our highest priority missions, was to try to capture a prisoner. And if you got a prison snatch, the whole unit that was out there all got a 3-day pass to Cambodia or someplace, not Cambodia, I'm sorry, to Thailand or someplace. And it was a deal. They would go out there and they had a sandbag usually to put over the guy's head. They had these little plastic handcuffs that you see in riot control and stuff like that. And they also had a 25 caliber silenced pistol. So what they were trying to do is get somebody dragging his ass at the end of a column, catch him, if they had to, shoot him, and then drag him out of there before the word got out. Now, anyway, that's a little background. They called in 10 minutes out. They had a gut shot sergeant, a butt shot Kong, and two dead guards. When a prison snatch turned sour, the AK smoke grew thick. Sweeney always tried a butt shot. Like he said with flawless logic, they can't run fast, and they often leak slow. Well, this one turned sour with a vengeance. The six-man snatch team thought they'd found a straggler when he was really running point. The bird was a flying disaster. They were using fuel. They were losing fuel, pressure, and altitude. They came out of the west like a smoking bomb. They missed my tent by a foot. Their controlled crash seemed a mite short of control, but they all managed to jump clear, except the gut shot sergeant, the butt shot Kong, and the two dead yards. It's never really easy to load a Huey in a fight, but the pilots held her steady as a rock. With their assholes chewing cushions and their foreheads sweating blood, they talked quietly between themselves. I think they prayed a lot. But the pilots held her steady while they laced her full of holes. Oh, their gunners joined the clatter. And the fact, he dropped some smoke. God bless the gunship. It was him that saved the day. Yes, the gunship bought the time. The pilots used it well. We pulled out the gut shot sergeant and the butt shot Kong and the two dead guards, and we foamed the whole thing down. Doc patched the sergeant up. He's serving, not brag. He stopped the Kong from leaking. Then two listened to his song. Oh yeah, we took the guards back home like we promised to. We paid their widows fair and square, like we always do. And sometimes when I've been drinking lots or times when I can't sleep, I think about that sergeant who eats six small meals a day. I wonder about those mountain girls. Did their $60 take them far? I think about that poor scared kid. Is he still alive? And if he is, when he sits, does he favor right? Mostly I just wonder what the hell he told them. And was it worth the price? On that awful day, the bird came home with a gut shot sergeant, a butt shot Kong, and two dead guards. I guess I should have mentioned that two is the intelligence officer it was in the Army in those days. It doesn't matter what the level, from battalion to reinforced corps, the two was the intelligence officer. And in our case, it was a young captain. But now the next thing we're going to do is wrap the poems up. We're going to talk, I left this unit and I went to the Palace Guard. Well, I was in charge of the defense of the city of Nha Trang, which is a big outfit. They had one of the biggest airfields in Nha Trang there. And on the airfield was a hospital. And the hospital had a nice little club called the treatment room. And I'd spend a lot of time there. In the evenings, I would set my ambushes. And they weren't all mine. I was more of a coordinator than I was anything else. I had some folks out there doing some stuff, but we had the Korean Marines, we had some of the Korean Army, we had the Rough Puff, which is the regional forces, and one of the other reserve unit type things that the Vietnamese had, and the White Mice. That was the National Police, had white uniforms and ran like mice. White Mice was a very good name for them. Anyway, there was about, in my area of responsibility, there was about 150 ambushes out at night. And they all reported to me where they were going to be, how long they were going to be there, and stuff of this nature. So I would have a briefing and tell everyone where the ambushes were so they didn't step on them and get in a firefight, get themselves killed. And then nothing much would happen. My command post was just about a mile or two down the road from the hospital. So the people wouldn't start making contact. There wouldn't be any firefights or anything until about midnight. So I'd go up to the club and sit around with the people at the hospital. And that's where this next poem came from. There was one more thing I've got to explain to you. We were on an airport, on a big airport, and there was aircraft going over our head all the time. Helicopters, fixed wing of various types. Well, you didn't try to get this education, you just automatically got it. You could tell by the speed and the altitude of the stuff going over your head what it was. The different kind of aircraft, you know, because some had to fly to the far end of the field, some were coming in lower. The helicopters, about 75%, landed 2 or 3 miles, 2 miles at least, from the hospital. But the ones who were coming in with medevac, they would come over and they would be a little lower, and almost over the club, you would hear them make this tight turn, and they'd start chopping power and landing. So you could tell what was going on without having a radio or anything, just by being there and listening. Okay, this thing's called The Party. We sat and drank warm beer at the hospital. Death was far away. Laughter and music were everywhere. It almost made the loneliness bearable. I laughed about my children, reminisced about my wife. We told R&R stories. Hong Kong, Kuala Lumpur, Australia. Fat Gal sang a torch song. A hollow-eyed doctor did country. We felt young and clean and collegiate. And then we heard them. One, two, three dust-offs beating the air in the awful rush against time. They turned overhead and fluttered out of the sky with the noisy clumsiness of chickens dropping from aloft. The party was over. I was back at war. I could also add to that party. You saw almost no, well, very, you saw much fewer helicopters coming in with wounded in the middle of the dark. It was dangerous and incredibly dangerous and hard to get out there. So if they had more than one helicopter and it was coming in at night, there was something bad going on somewhere. And of course that added to the feeling. I wrote a little memoir of my whole Army career about 7, 8, 9 years ago. And being kind of semi-retarded as I am, I t- took a memoir writing class in 2000, and we were doing various pieces just off the top of our head that came from somewhere in our background. At that time, I wrote this little thing, and it's not 100% accurate. I flowered it up, jazzed it up a couple places, but this is basically a true story. And it's in a different way. This is not under any stretch of the imagination a poem. Prologue. The unit was a special operations border Green Beret unit used to track North Vietnamese NVA movements. Commanded by a lieutenant colonel, the unit consisted of approximately 55 Americans, 400 mountain yards, and 8 Air Force helicopters with crews. During the Vietnam War, the media reported confirmed American sources state that such and such a NVA unit has entered South Vietnam from Cambodia or Laos. We were that source. The basic surveillance unit was a 6-man patrol of 2 round eyes and 4 yards. Little boys. We were all at the chopper pad, the usual gang, the old man, the intel officer, the operations officer, all ready to get the team down to debrief. Doc was there, he was always there. But when a team came out hot, he was always loaded for bear. We'd gotten the word that a yard had been hit bad. Plus, this was a hot extraction, which meant the guys had such high adrenaline levels that many had been grazed or even nicked really rough, wouldn't notice it for a half hour after touchdown. The Huey came in and all but the shot up yard jumped out with that wild grin that only guys who've just escaped with their lives can have. The team walked over to the edge of the pad and I passed them out their 1 beer ration. The only thing they were allowed to do before debrief was to drink 1 beer and take a quick piss. They usually did both at the same time. The choppers moved 200 yards away to their revetments to rearm and refuel. Most of the rest moved out for debrief. Doc was bent over the yard. God damn it, he yelled. He spun around in a complete circle, beating the air and cursing wildly. God damn it, he's dead. I need somebody to help me carry him to the aid station. I couldn't believe that he and I were the only people left. I guess I'm elected, I said. Doc grabbed him under the arms and I took his feet. We walked about 30 yards or so to the aid station. Then we kind of threw him on a litter. Doc pulled down the kid's pants and started winding one of those wide rubber bands like the post office uses around the guy's neck. I jumped back and thought, what the hell is this, hobo hell or something? Still shocked, I said, what the hell are you doing that for? He snarled at me, because I don't want this damn yard pissing all over my aid station. He rolled him roughly over on his stomach and yelled over his shoulder, pull his cheeks apart. He started pushing 4x4s up the kid's butt, then started taping the damn thing with 4-inch wide tape, almost from his waist to below his butt. While he worked, he said, I don't want him shitting either. I was still shocked. Can we put this kid back together with a little dignity, I asked. I guess so, he said, kind of vacantly. I pulled the kid's pants up. God, he was a mess. I think he'd caught a burst of fire of some kind of automatic weapon. He was torn up from his left leg above the knee all the way to his shoulder. He still had his shirt on. It was just one big slippery mess. I said, Doc, can I clean his face up? If you want, he scowled at me. The kid had green and black tiger stripes on his cheeks and across the bridge of his nose. I got some alcohol. Cleaned his face up real good. As his body cooled, his face was losing that pained look and falling into its natural features. Just a happy kid. Good God, he looked 10 years old. I mentioned it to Doc. Yeah, he said, damn yards all look like kids. Tell her about 30. The ones that live that long look like 60 plus, and then they fade fast. He looked closer as he straightened the boy's arms. He folded them across his chest. He said casually, if you don't fold them up before they stiffen up, and you might have to break an arm just to get them in the box. This kid may be 18, but you're right. He looks 10 years old lying there. I thought of my oldest son, Chuck. He was 10. If you bleach this yard and dusted some freckles across his face, they could be twins. Are you finished with me, Doc? He snarled, yeah, I don't need you anymore. I stepped out of the aid station and took maybe 3 steps. Then it hit me right in the pit of my stomach. I was standing upright and I coughed my cookies. My wife calls that projectile vomiting. I was spitting my lunch all the way to Cameron Bay. And then came the second wave. By the time the third wave hit, I was on my knees, tasting the hair on my ass. It was all I had left. It was then I realized I was crying. My whole body shook, and I was in the middle of the goddamn road, and I was crying. The dust was so thick. Every time I hurled, I raised a dust cloud. Later, God knows how much later, I felt a hand on my shoulder. It was the Sergeant Major. I didn't even try to control myself. You look like a goddamn 10-year-old kid, I cried. I was beginning to get a little composure. He looked away as he spoke. I wondered if that was to spare me any more humiliation or because my breath smelled like vomit. I began to feel really ashamed of myself. He was a senior enlisted man in the camp, and I was a second senior officer. I said, I'm sorry, Top, that kid, that little boy, that 10-year-old kid, there was no one in there to give a shit. Doc threw him around like a rag doll. He didn't care. His voice took on an edge. He said, we all care. We've all been there. Why do you think there was no one around when Doc said the kid was dead? I started to blubber like a 5-year-old. I said, but Doc didn't care, I could tell. The Sergeant Major yelled at me in his Sergeant Major voice. He yelled, Doc's in there right now, gulping about 8 ounces of Canadian whiskey out of a bottle he thinks I don't know about. He damn well cares. Then his voice softened. He said, I suggest you get cleaned up a little. The debrief will be over soon. You know, we all need to be at the club for tonight's show and tell. We need to be there to toast the heroes, to talk the talk. The yards will take care of the room. We need that seat at the club as long as it takes. About 2, maybe 3 hours later, we were all getting a little drunk. We toasted our asses off. We toasted the team. We toasted each other. We toasted the whole damn world. We were about to end the evening. I was feeling a little better. I yelled over the din, I got a toast. Everybody raised their beer glasses and whiskey glasses. I said, I want to give a toast to Chuck. As we drank, someone in the back of the room yelled, who the hell is Chuck? My eyes moistened, but my voice didn't break, and I said, he's just a little boy, a 10-year-old kid in Texas. I've been thinking a lot about him lately. That's pretty much it. I kind of shot my wad, but if you want to call me, talk about other stuff, that's okay, but I really, that's what I got. Now, when my daughter finally typed these for me, there's a few typos, pretty bad, like Cameron in the last thing. Cameron Bay is not spelled Cameroon, but I don't know how to spell the damn thing. Anyway, I had her put on these poems the year that the events happened, but the poems were all written in 80, whatever the heck it was, on the 10th anniversary of the war ending. Just for background, for what it's worth. Probably isn't worth all that much. Anyway, I guess I've shot my wad. I apologize. I sometimes get emotional when I read these things, but at the same time, I feel if you're going to understand them at all, I ought to read them because, I don't know. Anyway, thank you very much for putting up with everything, and now I can get my kids off my back, and thanks. Goodbye.